Welcome to the Umbrella Hour. The Umbrella Hour is brought to you by the International Institute of Clinical Sexology. Your hosts today are Dr. On, board-certified clinical sexologist, and Xander Keg, licensed clinical social worker. I'm going to turn this over now to you, Xander, so you can introduce our guest.
Yes, thank you so much, On. I am looking forward to this interview. I know I say that every time because every time I am looking forward to the conversation that we have with our guests. We have awesome guests on our show. And today our guest is Gray Doolin. Gray is a mentor and a guide for authentic embodiment. We're going to be talking more about what that means. Welcome to the show, Gray.
Thank you, Xander. Thank you, On. I'm really excited to be here.
You're very welcome. Why don't we just start out by talking about your journey to becoming a mentor and a guide for authentic embodiment? I feel like you could start in your childhood practically, but yeah. You figure out where you want to start and what you want to include. But what was that journey to becoming basically who you are and what it is you're doing? And then we're going to launch into a variety of different topics along the way.
Yeah, that sounds great. I just started my childhood and it's still an ongoing process. It's been a lifelong journey back to both returning to my body and returning to the energies that are authentic to me and not the stories and conditioning and expectation and dreams and values of other people. So I came out super young as trans. I told my parents I was a boy when I was 6 years old, 5 or 6. And so this was early to mid 80s in Iowa in a Pentecostal family. And that wasn't a very popular announcement to be making. I just remember just how earnest and like authentic I was about it. It was so clear to me. It was just like, I'm a boy, you know, and like no shame. I didn't have any qualms about it at all. And the outside world did. Yeah, I learned really early that in order to survive and get my needs met and to not be bullied at school and to not be bullied in public restrooms and to fit in, that I needed to suppress that part of me. When you look at kids and see their divine light, and then you watch slowly as they're in the world, how that dims and dims and dims. I mean, that was my light that got slowly crushed. Yeah, in order to make it, to survive and to not be in so much pain about what it felt like to be different in the world.
What year was it when you were 6? How did you even know this? Because when I think back when I was 6, I was eating mud.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. So when I was 6, it would have been 88. Yeah.
It was in the early 70s when I was 6. So it does make a difference.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, transness still at that time, no one knew what it was. Like there was not trans visibility. When I can have compassion for my parents, they were in a church setting. They didn't know what the heck to do with me. Truly, what does one do with a trans child in the 80s? No one knows. But I think, like I said, for myself, how I learned that was through pain. My parents didn't protect me and stand up for me when I was bullied, especially in restrooms. My parents didn't take care of me. My parents didn't protect me when I was bullied at school. I didn't have anyone to stand up for me. I think I learned very quickly that this existence was really painful and no one had my back. Kids are so wise and they're so tender that there was only so much of that pain that my body and psyche and heart could actually carry. I think that whether it's chronic trauma or stress that kids are raised in are these like acute moments, the system is just, it's so wise. It's going to protect you. No tiny body could possibly bear that much pain. And so then you're going to, right, you'll leave your body or you become the clown or you're on the defensive or you numb out through all the ways people numb out now. Like that's, the body's just so wise. And then for me, part of that, the reclamation of embodiment then is slowly undoing those defenses that came up to protect me, to return to that authentic core that I believe that I came into the world with and then had to set aside in order to survive or be liked or maintain relationships or appear smart. Again, all of the ways we compensate or need love, all of these false selves in order to feel less pain, to do away with that, one, but then also to actually literally come back into the body, sensation-wise, feeling-wise. It's on both the psychological self level, but then also actual embodiment in the sensational physical body too.
Great. Would you say that it's a false sense of self, or how does a child translate that? Because you're just surviving, right?
Correct. Yeah. A child doesn't have the cognitive capacity or development to understand it as a false self. And to them, it's No, it's about survival. You know, I could put on this mask or this persona that will then get me this thing. You know, it will get me love, or it will give me approval, or it will calm my mom's anger for a minute, or maybe dad won't drink tonight, or the kids at school won't bully me if I wear this pink outfit now and I hate pink, you know, or whatever. So it's this performative way, but the child isn't thinking, oh, this is false. It's thinking like I can get what I need and what I want, which is also developmentally appropriate. Kids need approval. Kids need validation. This is how we develop our healthy sense of self. So if you aren't getting that, you are going to figure out how you get it.
Yeah, it's coping mechanisms.
Yeah.
Yeah. I often talk to people about how whatever it is we had to do in our younger life to stay safe and alive, eventually it stops serving us.
Yes.
And it starts to really get in the way of our ability to connect with other people, to That's be correct. In relationship, to succeed, right, in life in whatever way we want to. And so maybe we could pivot into where was it that you started to think about and come to terms with or realize that maybe I'm not going to say it exactly how you would say it, but staying stuck in the trauma, it stopped. It didn't work anymore. There was the next thing or the next place or the next phase. And when did that start to happen? And what did you do to get yourself out of that? Because I would imagine that the listener might be in a similar place. My life has been difficult. The life around me is difficult, and they can't see any way out of it. How can I be happy? How can I be doing pleasurable things when all this suffering is going on, right? Yeah. That's not unusual for people to think that.
Yeah.
But it sounds like the kind of work you've done on yourself and what you're now doing with other people can get them into that place.
Yeah, for sure. Well, and there's this through line with clients that I work with, and it sounds dramatic, but because that's how it feels internally, this desire to escape their life, not in a suicidal way, but in this life that I've built up around me from that, the things that made me feel safe once or from a survival perspective, exactly what you named, Xander, is that at some point, it no longer rings true and you can feel the hollowness in it. But here you've got this world that you've constructed around yourself to feel safe that now feels like a prison. It's this fortress that you've built around. And I've had many of these come to Jesus moments where I'm like, oh man, this is not aligned. But the big shaker for me was when I suppressed the transness when I was young, but then, you know, came out as a lesbian at 19. So I was living queer life, but had really suppressed that transness. And then when I was in my doctoral program, when I look back at that time, I was finally, like, I had a chosen family. I had this really big network of queer activists. I was so active in activism around Madison where I was in grad school. I was writing. I was just so connected. And it was a time when my system finally felt safe enough again that transness reemerged. I remember so vividly, I was standing on the corner of a street waiting to cross to go to class one day, and this flash came up. I think I'm trans. And it like made me nauseous, so tied to trauma for me, it made me almost sick. So to shove that down for a little bit more, but that's when it really started to bubble up. That false life that I had built, especially going to grad school, I had really built this house on sand, is what I call it. I had the partner, and, you know, I like had the 13-page CV, and I was an academic and research. I had just overcompensated for how terrible I felt about myself with all of these external accolades. I was so lonely. I was so unhappy, really had that in that the through line that I see in my clients now is just, how do I get out of this? I have no idea. I stop one thing and the whole thing comes tumbling down. And that was terrifying. And it's what I did. I left the partnership, even though I had asked this woman to marry me. I was engaged. I broke that off. I eventually left my doctoral program a year out from being finished. I did take these really scary, courageous steps. I was so far from myself and I knew it. There was so much emptiness there.
I've heard other people say that they left the doctorate program not because of trans identities or any struggle with their sexual orientation or anything, but something jostled their moment of braveness and they decided, well, if I could do a doctorate, I can do this. And so they completely disconnected and moved forward with their dreams. And that's what it sounds like to me. You did.
Yeah, that's a lovely reflection. I love that reframe. Thank you. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't think I saw it at the time. And it took me about maybe a decade to, I don't know. It was That was one of the hardest things to walk away from my life. I mean, Anna, I don't know what your background is, but to do a PhD is a huge undertaking. I mean, it just is significant time and energy investment. And not everything I left behind there, and this is some of the teasing I've been doing out in my journey to the authentic embodiment, was what parts of me was an academic that loved the research and loved the community and loved connecting around a shared thing. The statistician in me, I was like such a numbers nerd. What parts of those things were actually true about me versus what were the things that I was all of the pushing past my limits and my boundaries to get approval and to do these things. Those things were not authentic. And then in the process, I've been able to reclaim what pieces of the PhD are that curiosity and knowledge seeking actually are true parts of me. And I think that this is also part of the work that as we're like untangling and undoing, what are the things that I've taken on that actually do belong to me that feel authentic? What are my parents' values or society's values? That's like part of the detective work that I love guiding people through so much. Oh, you think the social justice maybe value or whatever is yours, but maybe you've taken that on from these communities you've been a part of. And how do you really feel about this thing? And can you let that come forward now?
When you say there are these bits and pieces of yourself where perhaps you were looking for approval, you have to have approval to pass your doctorate. You have to. You can't do it any other way. And there's a lot of pressure there.
100%. Yeah.
You were talking about that building of that fortress, the sort of protection that we develop. And when that starts to fall apart, it can be very scary. It's very destabilizing, disorienting, right? And I don't know if you've heard of this book. I read it many, many years ago. It came out in 1998. It's called Going to Pieces Without Falling Apart. And it's written by an American psychiatrist who is a practitioner of Buddhist meditation. And so blends these Eastern and Western ideas of how to accept the self, how to let these things go, right? To fall off, but to not lose ourself. The goal is to actually learn who you are.
Yeah.
Right. Maybe for some people, it's actually becoming, because the first 10, 15, 20 years of life is orchestrated for so many of us. We're at the whim of our parents, our teachers, the other members of our family, the leaders in our communities. And if we're in religious communities, those individuals, the laws, the everything. And so I went into the military, right? So it's like we're governed, we're regulated. So it makes sense that developmentally, that age of in our 20s is when we're starting to really figure out who am I and what do I want and what am I going to do, that identity formation period.
Yeah.
And then you bring into it things around gender identity, sexual orientation. It's not easy. And so there's a lot of people that are navigating these things without guides, without mentors. I think people just think, oh yeah, trans people, we just take hormones and we change and we shift and we adjust. Yeah. And are you kidding me? Which is why I worry about the children doing these things, because it's hard enough for adults to navigate a medical, legal, social, and intrapersonal transition and interpersonal. Kids are learning how to tie their shoes and then they're learning how to do their multiplications. I don't know if we should pile all this other stuff on top of them. There's so much. And there isn't a lot of mentorship in our community. I've been tapped into mentorship since I first started my transition because I knew about it beforehand. It was big in the military mentorship. But a lot of what you're doing, you're using the word guide, but mentorship, guidance, coaching, right? They're all different. They serve their own unique purposes. But I'd love to hear how it is that you dropped out of your doctorate program, which was in psychology, correct? Mm-hmm. You would have been a psychologist.
Mm-hmm.
And you dropped out of that. You haven't returned. You didn't decide, oh no, I actually do want to do that. And now you're on this path of being a coach and a guide and a mentor. How did you get to the place where you felt you could actually do that? Because there are a lot of people in our community, the trans community, who become guides or mentors or coaches who are barely handling their own lives.
Yeah, 100%. I do know.
Yes. Yeah. What did you do to get to the place where you're doing this work? And maybe just tell us a little bit more about what the work looks like.
Yeah, for sure. Before I answer that, too, I just want to, something you said about the, when you named that book, The title of my Substack is called Unshakable. And I don't want there to be this misconception that being unshakable means that you aren't moved or you aren't impacted or you aren't disoriented. The way you find your center is to be knocked off and to come back and to be knocked off and to come back. But falling apart without falling to pieces, that's what it's called. To me, that's what that speaks of. In the trans community, particularly, I've seen developmental delays. Like, I'm not throwing shade, but if you think about that, if folks are stunted at the time where they're coming out and then they aren't passing through other appropriate or age appropriate developmental milestones, there's like a stuckness there. And so a lot of the things that folks who don't have deep identity development things, cis folks, straight folks, yeah, they're going through major, like, who am I exploration at 20s. But if you aren't even mature wise 20 as a trans, you aren't going to do that until you mature into that. So, right, you might be in your 40s, you might be in your 50s, you might never do it. And that then speaks to your question, Xander, which is that I have done an immense amount of transmuting my pain and trauma, the pain and trauma of my life, in order to grow my capacity, one, to have a sturdy enough self-concept to both hold myself, and then so that I am stable enough and sturdy enough then to hold space for other people. Because you're right, that's the availability of thriving and stable and integrated trans folks. It's few and far between. And I think it should be a more publicly talked about grief in our community and in our in trans communities. It's not just a singular. That's a real absence. And that is a huge tragedy. It is deeply sad. There isn't more guidance there for that.
I've actually found that on a few occasions, not very many, but it's also because I don't really talk about it much. It stirs things up that there's almost this sense that if you're not pissed off or experiencing a lot of negativity, then one, you have a lot of privilege. That's the retort. You don't care, or you're disconnected from reality. Being wounded has almost become a division of what is normal in our community, which I find really troubling.
Yeah. This is how we belong. If you do not have a narrative of pain and suffering, you do not belong. Right. You're either privileged or, you are an other. It's your card, your trans card. Is your life really hard? Are you full of suffering? Will it never get better? Oh, okay. Here's the cost of admission. And that's why I was like, no, thank you.
Don't you think some of that isn't authentic? Some of that is the expectation. As Xander was pointing out, we hear so many of these narratives. And if that is perhaps something that exists among a number of trans individuals as a sense of belonging. Oh, I can tell the same story. So therefore, you can relate to me or I can relate to you.
1,000%. Yeah, it is the very thing. I mean, it's similar to like trauma bonding. It's the very thing that keeps us connected. Makes me feel safe. It makes me feel less alone. So I'm not even criticizing it more than just observing it. And it's not from I have deep compassion for it because I used to live it and embody that too, because it serves a real purpose. And I think that, and my work around empowerment through a different narrative is that it doesn't have to be that way. No one ever told me that. Is this literally what the rest of my life is going to be like? And if that's true, what is this life?
When did you come to that place?
Maybe 10 or 11 years ago. I mean, that's relatively recent. And it's really when I started finding somatic work and coming into my body that after decades of talk therapy and trauma healing, that things actually began to shift for me. Oh man, there is a different way here. When I talk about this as this thread of just, what's the word I use? It's just like this. It's not resilience, but there has to be something different than this. This cannot be it. This cannot be the life that I was brought in to live. There's no way.
Have you heard of the concept by, his last name is Tlaib. I'm forgetting his first name, or maybe that is his first name, but he wrote a book called Anti-Fragility. And so if you think about resilience is the phoenix rising, right? And anti-fragility is more like the hydra. You cut off one head and two heads grow back. So adversity strengthens you.
Yeah.
And so there's no better word for it. He tried to come up with a better word for it. It's basically unbreakable. You think of Man's Search for Meaning, right? He was unbreakable, right? It's an interesting concept. Some people will talk also about post-traumatic growth. That's still kind of a resiliency because you were beaten down and you've come back up. Anti-fragility is you basically just superhero through adversity and you just accumulate strength from it. It never really knocks you down. It's a different way of thinking about going through adversity.
Yeah. Well, Xander, you and I have talked about before too about, and it's my view, as I understand transformation and healing, is that it is the transmutation of pain, though, that actually fuels and makes more space for the good to come in. I don't want listeners to hear that you got to hunker down and like build this shell around to get through, because then you're also missing the point about what it means to be vulnerable and open to life, right?
Yeah.
We will be taking our first commercial break. You are listening to the Umbrella Hour with Dr. Ahn and Xander Kegg. And our guest this hour is Gray Doolin, a mentor and guide for authentic embodiment. Let's take our first commercial break. We'll be back shortly.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
Imagine. Every day, clients walk into your office with their concerns about intimacy, identity, desire, and trauma. Questions that require more than basic training. Emotional and sexual dynamics are evolving, and today's professionals must evolve with them. We hear from parents unable to start conversations with their children around identity. Too often, adolescents have learned their sexual ideas from the internet. Couples have difficulty communicating about sex with each other. At the International Institute of Clinical Sexology, you can gain the specialized skills and knowledge to address those issues with confidence. Whether you are a therapist, coach, educator, or other healthcare professional, our advanced certifications and PhD program empower you to become a highly skilled, sought-after sex therapist. Expand your expertise. Elevate your earning potential. Start your journey today with the International Institute of Clinical Sexology. Imagine making a difference in our world. Learn more at clinicalsexologyphd.org.
The station that makes you feel good.
We are back from our first commercial break. You are listening to the Umbrella Hour with Dr. Ahn and Xander Kegg. Our guest this hour is Gray Doolin, a mentor and guide for authentic embodiment. Let's get back to the show.
I don't want listeners to hear that you got to hunker down and like build this shell around to get through, because then you're also missing the point about what it means to be vulnerable and open to life, right?
Yeah. You won't be with a shell.
That's correct. You will not be open with a shell.
Yeah. That's the thing. Yeah. We can't protect ourselves. What we were talking about a little bit earlier about, are the people really, is it really authentic for them to be out in the streets committing crimes, like vandalizing property and things like that? I remember when I took a women's studies class in college in the 90s, and I remember over the course of 12 weeks, it went from lighthearted, everybody was getting along with each other, people were all in college. And by the end of it, most of the women in the class were angry at all of the sexism and the patriarchy, and they were fighting with each other. We used to call it something like the Oppression Olympics, right? Like, who's the most oppressed? And by the end of it, we weren't even getting along with each other. That's the atmosphere that was created by the professor that got people all riled up. You weren't pissed off 12 weeks ago. Why are you so angry now? I can't even remember how many of the women by the end of the course had shaved their heads. They did that thing. This is the 90s, right? Yeah. Shaved their heads, went all Sinead on us. And here I was just, I don't know, I felt like I was this like normal lesbian. What are all you people doing? It's like, this is all new to you. You're just freaking out, you know? But yeah. I just stayed the same the whole way through. They were in their 20s. I was in my 30s. But still, I saw that happen. To me, that doesn't seem like a successful experience in a classroom. We could have been taught advocacy methods and all the women around the world throughout history that made a difference.
Yeah.
I think that would have been a better use of time. But yeah, it just reminded me of this idea of, is it really authentic? Or if they had the band leader who got them all playing the same song.
Inciting anger. And that's really irresponsible, in my opinion.
10, 11 years ago, you started to do that work. And then the somatic work, maybe you could talk to us a little bit about, maybe people aren't familiar with somatics, what that is and what you did and how it helped you. And then we can move into the work that you're doing now with people.
Yeah, right. Again, for decades, I just went to talk therapy. And I, again, see this with a lot of the clients that I work with, is they're so smart. And they could write me pages, books about how they ended up the way that they are, right? This happens often with the intellectual, very emotionally intelligent, high self-awareness, but they could talk about it, but they aren't feeling it. And that's the difference, right? And so for me, it was just the first somatic methodology that I did was EMDR, which was both neurology and then coming into the body with sensations and shifting trauma in the brain, rewiring the brain that way. And then that's when I began to really, oh, wow, this is a difference. And then I started doing somatic experiencing, which is like a slower, more body-based, at the speed of the body, looking for places of contraction and tension or where stress and trauma are held, and then essentially finding places in the body that feel less tight, and then helping the body remember what it does naturally. All of our bodies pendulate is the term, where you go back and forth between tightness and openness, safety and not safe. But it's helpful to do it in community, so, or with another person to help co-regulate, to help hold that, or be the, they call it the counter vortex to the trauma vortex that you're in. And for me, there was such an overlap in my transness, because my experience of transness, one, yes, it is a spiritual experience for me, but it's an embodied experience. Transness is in the body. I wanted to be in my body. I want to be an embodied trans person, not just thinking about it, also not fragmenting these female parts or the dead names, all that stuff that doesn't resonate with me, because I'm on a journey to wholeness, not chopping myself up in any deeper ways. A thing I didn't understand at the time, though, is that to grow greater capacity for the joy and the pleasure means that you're going to have to be really uncomfortable. You're going to be uncomfortable. You're going to feel pain. You're going to grieve a lot more than you think you should have to grieve. But also, if you think that 40 years in and you haven't grieved all of the things that need grieving, like, that doesn't just go away. It's still living in there, and it's showing up as your acid reflux, and it's showing up as your chronic inflammation, and showing up as your chronic fatigue, all of these symptoms. And I know that there's a really high rate of chronic illness and disability in trans communities. And again, right, I'm not a doctor. To me, there has to be some link between the lack of embodiment and disconnection there and the high amount of body issues that folks are experiencing.
We turn in on ourselves.
Correct.
We've had a guest on the show twice now, Dr. Kim McCoy. He's a trans man chiropractor out of San Francisco Bay Area. He's been in practice for about 25 years. And he does a very particular chiropractic work called NET, or neuro-emotional technique, where it works on identifying and releasing what they call unresolved emotional stressors that get stuck. And he described it at one point where he'll have people stick their arm out and then he's pushing against it, resist the push. And then he starts having them talk about the things that are bothering them. And eventually he can just push it straight down, because it's at its weakest when they're talking about the thing that's the most painful.
Yeah.
And so then they're like, okay, that's it right there. And so they work on disconnecting that from the body, how to release that. And it's not about denying or suppressing or even compartmentalizing, which is okay, you know, in the short term. It's literally about feeling through it and then letting it go. We don't have to hold on to the memories and the experiences. It doesn't invalidate what we've been through if we go through it and release it. We still know it happened, but we don't have to live with the repercussions of it every day. I mean, except for in some circles, people feel like they must, or else they'll get kicked out of the circle. But it's just going through that process of identifying the things that are just stuck.
Yep.
They're stuck in us.
Yeah.
He's unique too, because he has a hell of a sense of humor.
Yes.
And he always dresses in...
He does clowning.
He does. He dresses in a skeleton outfit.
I love that. I love the playfulness.
He wrote a book called The Issues Are in the Tissues that I highly recommend. It tells his story of transition also.
Cool.
In that I book. Love that. Yeah. So EMDR, my wife is a marriage and family therapist. She does EMDR. And then somatic experiencing, is that something similar to the NET?
The whole premise behind somatic experiencing therapy is that, right, that our bodies, again, they're very wise, and in their natural state, they move through stress cycles, because to be a human is to live in stress. That's, it doesn't need to be extreme, but there's little stressors that come up all the time. A healthy body moves through the cycle naturally, where a stressor will come up and it will move it through. The thing that happens with trauma and prolonged stress is that the energy, the charge from that stress gets trapped in the body. And so somatic experiencing helps the body metabolizes the charge. So there's a lot of paying attention to how the body wants to move. So if I'm talking about a memory that's coming up, or about my dad, and I see my arms going like this, right? The practitioner would help me slow that down, because there's something very wise in the body. And who knows why the body's doing that, but that's how it's living in there. And then when you allow that to move through, the body metabolizes it, and it's no longer there. So it's the metabolization of stress and trauma, but it helps you get freer, because you're not bogged down, again, with decades of unprocessed charge. If you think about every time a boundary violation happens, someone bumps into you at the grocery store, or you have to go to the dentist, and all of these ways our bodies are violated, and we don't just let that move through naturally. It builds and builds and builds. It's still living in there.
Well, that's interesting, because that makes me think of what people are talking about when they're referencing microaggressions. And they'll talk about how it's the 10,000 cuts, and it just builds and builds and builds, and it creates this reality. And it seems to me that people suggest the solution is that society just needs to change.
Right.
Right. Because if you say, well, you're going to spend the rest of your life interacting in a world with people who are going to do things that you don't like, and how are you going to deal with that? Because, I mean, I might be wrong, but I don't think the world is going to change to fit me, because then it would be a misfit for you, right? How can the universe change to fit me and you and on and everybody else? It doesn't work that way. But then people will say, well, the goal shouldn't be to accept bad behavior or abuse. Well, I didn't say accept.
Yeah.
I didn't say accept. I just said it's a type of acceptance, and it's a moving through it and then moving on. Doesn't mean you have to stay in that place, that work, that relationship, that whatever. You don't have to stay there, but that battle of this person should be doing something different than they're doing, I want them to stop, is going to create a whole lot of distress for you as a person to go through life like that. Right around 2020, when things started to shift around paying attention to microaggressions and not building resiliency and emotional intelligence, things started to switch. They even changed the emotional intelligence curriculum, the social emotional learning curriculum that they were using in K-12 programs, to go from emotional intelligence, mental fitness, to identifying microaggressions and calling out the people doing it. Well, no, that's not going to work.
Yeah.
Right. We can still make change, and we can bring attention to things, but we should be working on emotional intelligence and mental fitness
yeah.
at the same time.
Wait, I must have missed something. So why 2020?
Well, I think it was the issue with George Floyd.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Ferguson. And Black Lives Matter
and
the organization that created the social emotional learning that's used in the schools, one of them in particular, they changed their curriculum from social emotional learning to transformative social emotional learning, and they switched it around so that it wasn't like how to be resilient. It was how to call out everybody for all the bad things they're doing.
Yeah.
Which is not strength building for young people at all.
Right.
Yeah.
I also don't think talk therapy is for everyone. I think a lot of people can feel stuck if that is not helping them. And I think it's so important to be able to offer these various other forms of working with people. When you mentioned somatic body, when people are left wondering how they can move forward, and then you offer something, as what you were talking about, being more in touch with your body and paying attention to the inner signals, and looking at what's happening outwardly and how you are feeling in that moment is so much more important. And I'm not saying talk therapy isn't important, but I think we don't do enough of that, especially with young children. If we could just do more of that with young children, I think we could help them get unstuck. Not in every situation, but certainly in day-to-day, perhaps struggling in school or whatever it may be. So having said that, when you were in school and you were this six-year-old boy, right? How did you cope?
When I look back, I held my ground for a while. All through elementary school, I kept my hair short. I still dressed like a boy, and I just kind of put up with it. I don't know. I had a resilience of spirit even then, but it was a real... It was a real moment for me going into junior high, right? This because I knew I was about to be dumped into a larger school with a lot of students from other elementary schools. And that was the moment I grew my hair out. I started wearing makeup. I asked my mom to take me to get just different clothes. And so I just made the decision then that it was time for this version of me to go. And I also around that time, though, I started adapting in my high school graduating class, I was voted class clown, smartest mouth. So it was around that time that I really started developing this clown persona, or the screw off and the funny one and the one who jab at others. I lost my vulnerability. And for good reason, but it's taken me a lot of years, and it's still a practice of trying to teach myself and my body that it's safe to be vulnerable again. The world will treat me kindly, and I have people in my life now where I can be all of me and that will be received and loved. So,
yeah, it sounds like now the work that you're doing is centered around helping people to embody, right? Embody themselves in an authentic way, and not what they've been told is the authentic way, but what is truly authentic for them, which can't be easy. I can't even recollect what that process was like for me because it was slow over years. I think even as a kid, I was basically, I don't give a crap what you want or think. I basically dressed like a boy all the way through middle school and high school and college. And I just didn't care. I had a very internal locus of control in a lot of those situations, but not a lot of people do. So it sounds like some of the information that you provided before the interview was wanting to talk about and look at how we can create models of trans life that's rooted in health and integration and thriving. And you had already talked about it before, where belonging isn't contingent around having this trauma story. I also think about it in the way of belonging just to the world. I was in an event yesterday where somebody was asking me about my sense of belonging and I think they used a very long acronym. It was like 2S, LGBTQIA, Portland. They put the 2S, the two spirit, at the beginning. At the end, every place is different, but everybody else was talking in that way. And when it came to me, I was like, I always feel like I belong. I belong in the world.
Yeah.
I don't need to belong in the trans community. I belong because I live here. It's my world, you know, but we start small. I mean, I started in what I used to call the rainbow ghetto. I started in the gay community, yes. Right? And then moved my way out of it. This was back when I was in my late teens and 20s. But yeah, it's like, how? What are the models? Have you created this model? Is each of us have our own model? What's the thing about the models of having this life rooted in those things, the health, the integration, and the thriving?
I think we need more models of it. I am one model of it. You are one model of it. And I think that I would say, you know, with other interviews I've done and I've heard from people, there aren't a lot of people speaking about this in trans communities either. So many folks are afraid to let go of that victim and suffering narrative. But I know that people are feeling it, that it isn't working for them anymore. This can't be all there is. And so I think that I would say to folks, whether it's like a still, quiet voice or something that is like rumbling inside of you, but like you don't quite know where to look because there aren't a lot of other big communities saying, over here, thriving trans people, come over here, to really trust what your soul and heart and your identity, where it's calling you.
We will be taking our second commercial break. You are listening to The Umbrella Hour with Dr. Om and Xander Keg, and our guest is Gray Doolin, a mentor and guide for authentic embodiment. We are always grateful to our sponsor and therefore grateful to play their commercial. Stay tuned. We'll be back shortly.
UK Health Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Sarah wasn't bad at her job, she was stuck in hidden grief. After her dog died, she took a sales role just to stay busy, but every pitch felt empty. A Cogna Movement session uncovered that she was seeking the warmth of her dog rather than serving her clients. Using our patented movement and sensory patterns, she cleared the grief and rocketed to the top. What hidden emotion is holding you back? Try our Essentials program at the special UK Health Radio rate. Visit cognamovement.com/radio or click on the Cogna Movement banner on the UK Health Radio homepage. Results vary.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving. It's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
We are back from our second commercial break. You are listening to the Umbrella Hour with Dr. On and Xander Keg, and our guest is Gray Doolin. Let's get back to the show.
Here we are having this conversation. I want you to know that it exists. You can belong to the entire world. I mean, similar to my experiences, once I let go of needing to belong in trans communities, my life opened up so much more. It's so exciting. I can go anywhere. I don't hinge my safety anymore on whether or not I belong as a trans person. I could give two what you think about my transness. It's different.
I don't need other people to accept me, welcome me, affirm me. I don't need that. I've done it for myself.
Correct.
Right. So I'm not afraid to go anywhere. Now, I'm not going to be stupid.
Well, yeah.
There's places I'm probably not going to go to. But even then, I'm just projecting. I don't really know. I'm still running on assumptions that those people might be dangerous. Maybe I'll test it out.
I mean, during the pandemic, I left Minneapolis for a couple of years. And the first year I left here, I lived in rural Wisconsin on this lake, very like red part of Wisconsin, just on this like street with a bunch of like what I called Wisconsin bro bachelors, you know, and I wasn't like out trans to like, we didn't talk about my transness, but again, like I didn't need them to see or affirm me because I was solid enough in who I am. I just didn't need that. But it also gave me a really cool opportunity to connect with these men that I never would have connected with otherwise, to like get my own little pickup truck, just blend in and live, you know, it's like kind of that like stealth being a voyeur, and you get to experience the world with this really unique perspective. And it was just cool to, like I said, connect with people I never would have sought out, or it was just a really cool experience. I was able to do that because I felt safe enough within myself that I could go and have that adventure.
What I love about that too is you're describing a fairly common experience, which is a person will assume that there are people there who don't like them. So they're not going to go there, but they're also going to, as part of the defense mechanism, they're going to other the people in that place or who do that thing, which is a very dehumanizing action. And I'm pretty sure that none of those people that are doing that dehumanizing would want to be dehumanized, right? They're not recognizing that when I other someone, then I'm opening myself up to be othered. And how can I ask people to not other me when I'm othering them? It's sort of like, well, you know, you go first. You stop dehumanizing me. No, just stop dehumanizing and othering and just stop doing it and open yourself up to the possibility that people might think differently than you, believe different things than you, but they don't actually hate you and they don't believe that you aren't worthy of a full life.
Yeah.
They just have some qualms about certain things that, quite honestly, a lot of trans people agree with. It doesn't mean you can't break bread with them, right? There's so many people now that are going hashtag no contact, right? I'm not on social media, but I hear about this stuff, right? They're estranging themselves from their family because their family members don't use the right words or don't have the right beliefs or voted for the wrong person. They're choosing to alienate themselves, which is just going to create isolation, which is going to lead them to not feel very good. They're going to turn around and say, it's that person's fault that I feel this way.
That's correct. Yeah.
Yeah. We didn't talk too much about it. We're coming to the end, but about mentorship. And I'm a big fan of mentorship. You and I have had this conversation. If you want to talk just briefly about what that means for you and how you're doing that in your life.
We're having the conversations now, just in the work that I'm doing. That's the mentorship there, which is modeling and helping and really supporting folks in different ways of being, which is to do a lot of parts work and integration and coming in, a lot of dropping into the body. I have a lot of conversations with especially trans men around integration of feminine parts. And again, they don't even need to be presented. Let's not kill them off. Let's, because they're still out there, let's bring them in. So things like that. But again, the modeling, the mentorship of, so I run these trans mentoring circles. And I'm going to do it different this spring. Like I did like a little 5-week thing around loneliness when the pandemic was happening. So this year I'm going to spread it, have it be 3 months and meet twice monthly to let the body just have more time to integrate. And the first one I'm going to be doing, which will run May, June, July, is going to be about embodiment specifically. But the embodiment piece is, you've got to have that there before you can build anything else on top of that. Even if it's pleasure or sexuality, how are you going to get into your erotic if you think your body is a disgusting place to be? So that's how I am helping folks live into that mentorship as well. But we need, again, I like want to see a different type and a different story and a different level of embodied empowerment being lived into rather than, oh, life is so hard and I'm struggling so much and let's connect around that.
And is it through your Substack, Unshakable, that people can learn more about this trans mentoring circle that's coming up? They can learn about it there. You also have a website?
Yep, I do have a website, graydoulin.com. So the Unshakable on Substack is where my weekly emails go out then. So the announcements and the information about the trans mentoring circles will go through there. It'll be on my website as well, but the ongoing information about the offerings will also be on my Substack.
I appreciate that we've had the opportunity to talk about not just your life, but also what you made of it, how you persevered. You rose from those ashes and now you're doing wonderful things that are leading other people out of those places as well. And we've got to get many, many more to have that experience. And then it will be the norm in our community. Thanks for being on the show, Gray. We don't say it very often. We probably should do it more often, but we should have you back on.
I would love that.
Thank you.
Thanks, Gray.
Yeah, thank you both.
We have come to the end of the Umbrella Hour. You've been listening to Gray Doolin. Gray is a mentor and guide for authentic embodiment. You can check him out on Substack at Unshakable Core, C-O-R-E. We hope that you enjoyed this hour. Until next time, thank you for listening.